MechCast, Thursday, April 9th, 2015. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the MechCast. Can you feel the energy? Can you feel the anticipation? We are literally, as I record this, hours away from pre-orders for the Apple Watch. I am super excited. I expect many of you to be up with me at 12:01 a.m. Pacific time ordering your Apple Watch. For those who aren't or don't plan to get one, we will be talking about the experience and how it went for all of us, and talking about the whys and what's and what fors, why should we get a watch, why shouldn't we get a watch, probably on many future episodes of the MechCast. But for this episode, we're going to be talking a little bit, might be a little bit weird, we're going to talk a little bit about the process of buying an Apple Watch. We know a little bit more about that moving into tonight's escapades. We're also going to be talking a little bit about Apple Pay. It's struggling a little bit at the register, why that's going on. The new MacBook is also going to be here tomorrow, so a few little updates on that and a little more information on Apple's on-demand TV service, as well as some software updates that are going out in advance of the new stuff coming out. We've got Photos to talk about. Photos app is now out and available. So we'll have that. We'll have some tips on that as well. I'm going to give you some tips on buying used iPhones. One of you had asked about my podcast workflow a while back in email. I'm finally getting around to going over that again. It's been a few years, I think, since we discussed that, so that's a good thing to get back into. Let you know kind of the equipment I use and just the whole process. And we got that, and plus my thing of the moment, which might surprise you a little bit. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, right now I said we're minutes away from the Apple Watch, so maybe you want to get some cash so that you can buy an Apple Watch. Well, a great way to do that is maybe to sell one of your old devices on Gazelle. Maybe you have an old iPad, an iPhone, Mac around that you're no longer using. Well, you can get cash for that on Gazelle, and they make it super, super easy to do. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. You select the item that you want to offer them. You answer a few questions about the condition, the accessories. They'll even buy broken devices, so don't worry if you've got a broken iPhone. They'll give you an offer for that. And right there, after you answer those questions, immediately they'll give you an upfront offer. And it's totally risk-free. You can take it or not. And if you do decide to take it, they will even provide shipping and in many cases provide you a box to send it in. And I usually use the box option if it's available because it makes it really easy. They send you the box to send the iPhone in. They give you great instructions, the labels, everything you need to do it. Like I said, they make it as simple as possible. And so you box it up, you send it in, and then you get paid fast. And you can get paid by check, you can get paid by PayPal, or even Amazon gift card. And if you choose the Amazon gift card option, you get 5% more on your offer. So I usually pick that one because I'm a big fan of Amazon as well. But the offer process literally takes just a few minutes, so you should do it today because the longer you wait, items can lose value over time. So you want to get in, you want to get your offer. You can lock that offer in so you can know I've got the cash coming. Once Gazelle receives my thing, I'm going to get paid quickly, but you're free to go ahead and you know, make that purchase if you need to do that. So Gazelle has handled over 2 million trade-ins. They've paid out over $175 million to their customers, and over 90% of people using Gazelle report having an excellent experience, and I am in that 90%. I've used them several times. Really great service. You should check it out. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute or two to find out what your iPhone's worth. Go to gazelle.com to find out more, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MechCast. So let's get in right into the thing that we are all excited about. That is Apple Watch pre-orders and also being able to finally make our try-on appointments. As a matter of fact, as I'm recording this, we're starting to already see some videos from down in Australia where they're already doing try-ons. And you definitely do have to have an appointment. So we'll get into that here in a little bit. But as far as how the Apple Watch sales are going to go, we're getting some predictions ahead of the launch from our friend Gene Munster. He told investors that he expects Apple to sell at least 1 million Apple Watches over the opening weekend of sales. I have a feeling this number is going to be really predicated on how much availability there is. And we're hearing that it's going to be constrained, possibly very constrained. I know we hear this every time a new Apple product comes out, right? But he's basing his number on less than 1% attach rate of total iPhone users, meaning current iPhone users who are actually going to buy the Apple Watch. So just based on the number of iPhones that are out there. And it wasn't clear if he was estimating on the number of iPhones that actually support the Apple Watch. I'm guessing that he was basing it on the total number. But less than 1% seems like a very reasonable number in terms of people buying Apple Watches. I think Apple will get more than 1% probably of iPhone owners, at least iPhone owners with eligible devices, buying Apple Watches. But that's the opening weekend, 1 million over the opening weekend. He also expects the sales will rise to about 2.3 million by June. So a lot of this is going to, you know, how the sales go is going to depend on that whole sales experience. And there has been a lot of confusion surrounding things like the try-on appointments and walk-in purchases, those sorts of things. Really, if you want to get a try-on, if you want to try these on in the store, your best bet is going to be to go online and actually create an appointment either through the Apple Store app or online. And we don't know exactly what that process is going to be like yet because those things haven't been activated, at least not for U.S. phones. Maybe some of you in Australia already know what's going on, but we haven't seen it yet. I think actually they're not even being activated until midnight tonight. So you're definitely going to want to do that. Now, we are getting, like I said, those reports from Australia. Walk-in appointments are being accommodated, but the way that's going to work is they're going to use a system similar to what's called their customer journey Genius Bar experience. And if you've been in for a Genius Bar appointment recently, you probably got this experience if you were doing it on a walk-in. And I got this information from Dave Hamilton over at Mac Observer. He had found out this info out. But basically what's going to happen is if you walk in, they will try and set you an appointment at the store. Now, they're not going to make you wait around like you did in the past. What they will do is ask you for your cell phone number, and they will contact you then when your appointment is available. So that could be several hours. It may even be that they have to schedule you for completely another day. But what you will get is a notification saying, hey, your appointment's coming up. We're ready for you. And I think you actually kind of get three notifications if they can get you back in the same day. So it'll be like, all right, we're almost ready for you. Okay, we're ready for you now. And I think there's three of them. You get the one when they set up the appointment. Hey, we've set you an appointment. Here's the time. And then you get the other two as you get closer to that. So you can make your way back to the store because a lot of Apple stores are in malls. You could go off and do some shopping, do some errands, do some other things. You don't have to sit around waiting. And that's the whole point. But really, I think because there's going to be so much demand, you're better off trying to set that appointment up front, get the time that you want. You don't want to be waiting around for a number of hours while you wait for your appointment to come up. But eventually, as far as buying, so that's just the appointment for actually doing a try-in. As far as buying goes, we know now officially from Apple that all purchases are going to need to be made online, at least initially. You're not going to be able during the initial launch period to actually walk into an Apple store and buy a watch. Now, I think once inventory becomes more available, things die down a little bit, that policy will change, but that's the way it is for now. In Dave Hamilton's piece, he had heard in terms of buying for the try-in appointments, once you are actually able to buy in store, what they're going to do is set you up two appointments back to back. So they'll set you up a try-on appointment and then a purchase appointment. It's sounding like the purchase experience is going to be somewhat like the try-in experience. They're going to have the watch there for you. They're going to bring it out. They're going to ask you if you want you want help setting it up. They'll get it linked up to your phone. They'll walk you through the features and process. So there is going to be a little bit of an experience. Apple really wants that jewelry store experience, and it sounds like that's how they are going to create it. But for, you know, on the 24th, if you want to watch, you are going to need to pre-order online. So that's why many of us are going to be waiting up. I'm sure you're going to be hanging out, waiting up with me tonight at 12:01. And hopefully Apple's system holds up. If any past experience is an indicator, it's going to be a mess. I think it's going to be a really big mess. And Apple is saying we are expecting huge, huge demand, and that demand is going to far exceed the available supply. So just be prepared for that. If you are in the market for the Edition watch, and if you are, congratulations to you. That is awesome. I'm not, but in case you are, the Edition watches are only going to be available at select locations. And until today, we really didn't know what those locations are. Now there is a list out. The easiest way to find out about it is to actually go on Apple's website, go to the store locator, enter the store that you want to go to, select the Watch Edition, and see if you can get it from the, you know, see if the Watch Edition comes up on the available products list. Just for the U.S., the quick list, you've got New York City, which is the Fifth Avenue Soho Upper West Side store. You've got Boylston Street in Boston. Two locations in Chicago, Lincoln Park and North Michigan Avenue, Walnut Street in Philadelphia, Georgetown in Washington, D.C., Lenox Square in Atlanta, Lincoln Road in Miami, Tyson's Corner Center in Virginia, in Newark, Delaware, the Christiana Mall. In the Bay Area, it's in San Francisco at the Stanford store. L.A. has two locations, the Grove on 3rd Street in Santa Monica and at South Coast in Costa Mesa. Then in Houston, Highland Village, Dallas, North Park Center, and Seattle, Bellevue Square. So those are the only locations in the U.S. and then a few other countries. I think there's one store in the U.K. So you really need to go online and look if you're in the market for an Edition watch to figure out which store to go to or which store to pre-order from. And I think in-store pickup is going to be available in the U.S. I think we heard in the U.K. that it might not be available. And there's some discrepancy on Germany. And we also had seen that there might be some delays in terms of delivery times and dates in Germany and maybe even the U.K. The numbers were floating around on Apple's website. The U.S. store didn't even have any ship date numbers. So we don't know if that was a mistake or anything. So take that with a grain of salt, but just be aware if you're in those countries or if you're outside the U.S., there, again, might be some shipping delays on certain models and things like that. Again, inventory looking to be really, really constrained. As far as software to run on your Apple Watch, though, there seems to be plenty of that. Over 1,000 Apple Watch apps have already been submitted to the App Store. I think that's a quote from Tim Cook himself. Oh, and I forgot to mention another thing. For Apple Store employees, this is pretty nice on the purchasing. Apple Store employees are going to get a 50% discount on the Apple Watch or the Apple Watch Sport. They will also get $500 off. Michael Johnson said it was $550. I thought I had read $500, but $500 or $550 off the Edition watch. I have a feeling not a ton of Apple employees are in the market for an Edition watch, but maybe more than I would think. Maybe they're going to cash in some of that stock or something like stock options and pick up some Edition watches, and they get to save $550. 50% discount, that's amazing on the Apple Watch and the Apple Watch Sport. I do know that employees are typically restricted, at least in the early period, from actually buying any of the new products. That usually happens with iPhones and iPods. So I'll be curious to find out if they can actually even make that purchase yet. They might have to wait a while again until the supply chain sort of filters out. AppleCare Plus is also going to be available for the Apple Watch, and we do have pricing on that now, and it is going to vary dependent upon the model that you pick. So it's $59 US for the Apple Watch Sport. It's going to be $79 if you're getting an Apple Watch, and $999 for the Apple Watch Edition. And that does give you the extra year of coverage on top of your default coverage, plus the accidental damage for the Sport and the Apple Watch. If you're on the Apple Edition, they'll add another year on to that. So you're paying that price premium for luxury. You're going to get 3 years total instead of just the 2 years total. And we haven't heard any word on what the accidental damage replacement cost is going to be for the various plans. So we're going to have to find that out a little bit later. And as soon as I know, I will let you know. Apple is planning on rolling out in 9 countries at first. More to come, probably quickly. U.S., Canada, Australia, France, Germany, Hong Kong, mainland China, Japan, and the U.K. are those first 9 countries. I think we've talked about that before. Switzerland may be a while before they get the Apple Watch in Switzerland. There was an interesting story out this week. A gentleman named William Lange owner of the Leonard watch brand, actually has, in the report that I read said it was a 1985 patent, but I think really what it was a trademark. He has a trademark on using the image of an apple or the word apple on a watch in Switzerland. And according to the report I read, it said that he was currently negotiating with Apple on terms to actually purchase the trademark. I've since read another report, this one from Apple Insider, that I believe a little bit more. I think it was Apple Insider that said he actually came out, William Lange came out and said, no, you know, I haven't been contacted with Apple. He saw this report. It doesn't sound like there's going to be any kind of fight or dispute. I don't think this is going to be a big issue. It'll be interesting to see if Apple just purchases the trademark from him, or if they just go the legal route, because the trademark hasn't been used. It was never used. They never produced a watch with a logo on it, so it might be fairly easy for Apple to actually fight the trademark issue if they really wanted to go down that route. But this could be a total non-story, but just interesting nonetheless. You know, Switzerland, you've got the Swiss watch. There has been word that there's been a lot of pushback. I think Johnny Ive even made some disparaging comments about, you know, they don't know what's coming. And there's been a little, you know, tit for tat kind of things going on. But I think it's all fun and games and in jest. I think eventually we'll see an Apple Watch in Switzerland. But it's probably going to be a little bit more time. That's kind of the latest we know on the Apple Watch. As far as your best bets for pre-ordering an Apple Watch, this may come a little bit late for you, but just in case you happen to get this podcast before 12:01 a.m. Pacific time, you're going to want to go into the App Store, Apple App Store app, and favorite some of your watches. That's going to make selecting and picking your watch and getting into your cart a little bit quicker. I think they also customize your try-on appointment based on some of your favorites. At least I had been reading that. We'll find out if that turns out to be true in a little bit here. And then you'll probably want to fire up both your web browser and the Apple Store app to make your purchase. Another thing is if you have an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, you probably want to make sure your Apple Pay is all set up, because you can use Apple Pay on the Apple Store, and that you've got it set up for your default credit card. So if you go into Settings, General, and then Apple Pay, I think it's Passcode and Apple Pay, you can then change your default card if you need to do that. So that way you save yourself one extra tap as you're going through. And it's probably going to be a good idea just, you know, for the next couple weeks, since it's going to be hard to get supply, to go on the app, to go on the website. They should have availability updates to show you which stores are going to have different models and inventory, so you can check that the night before. And then again, use these sort of same techniques, the Apple Pay, using the app to actually make your purchase and set up your pickup appointment or arrange delivery or whatever. I'm still trying to decide whether I'm going to do in-store pickup or if I will just have it delivered. I think this time around, I'm just going to wait for the UPS guy and get it delivered and not brave down to the Apple Store. I am planning on making a try-on appointment, hopefully tonight as well at 12:01 a.m., right after I make my purchase. That way I can go in, try on the different models, and hopefully I got the right model. If I go in, I do my try-ons and decide that I didn't get the watch that I wanted, it's going to be very painful to have to go back and cancel my order and then, you know, get to the back of the line, because I really think if you don't get your pre-order in tonight, you are going to be waiting several weeks, if not a month or more, probably to get your Apple Watch. You're not going to be able to get that on the 24th. Angela Arendt did send out a memo telling the Apple Store reps that they are going to try and push customers online if they do come in this store and encounter unavailable inventory. That was later confirmed again by that report that said, hey, we're having people order online. Really, it sounds like what they want to do is just set expectations. You know, they don't want customers coming down and being disappointed that they don't have in-store stock. It's going to ease in-store congestion and the lines outside the store for product launches. I have a feeling people are still going to line up in hopes that they're going to buy one online, but they're going to be a little bit sad this time around. So if you have friends and family who are thinking about waiting in line and doing the whole Apple Store campout thing, sounds like Rents really wants those things to be a thing of the past. So I'm a little bit sad about that. You know, the end of the Apple Store campout and the camaraderie we had there. But I think it does make sense. It's sort of been It's become a little bit of a joke in some circles. You know, we get jokes on late night television and we have the Samsung commercials and stuff like that. So I think Apple sort of wants to change that image and make the stores a little bit more about that personal customer experience. So the personal pickup, the personal try-ons, and also they're trying to deal with the whole scalping issue that they've been having over the last couple of years. And actually to that end as well, another thing that was reported is that it is going to be limited to one per customer. When you're making your purchase, you're going to have to show ID when you're actually picking up your Apple Watch. So if you're doing an in-store purchase, you're only going to be able to buy one. You're not going to be able to buy two. So if you're planning on getting one for you and a spouse, I think your spouse is actually going to have to go down with you. Again, at least in the early stages. I don't know if that's going to be a long-term play. But we've seen that before, you know, in terms of Apple limiting purchases on past releases, specifically with the iPhone a few years back. We're starting to also see packaging now. Actually, some of that got leaked before. I haven't seen any official unboxings yet, although I imagine if you go online by the time you hear this, you'll be able to see some of the official unboxings. We did see an unofficial one leaked out of, I want to say it was Taiwan, someplace like that. But there was a all-white box with the Apple Watch on it, and then you would open that up. There was an additional sort of plastic box inside that. And when you opened that up, you had the Apple Watch there on top in this sort of felt-lined area. There was a felt-lined ring stand or cuff, you know, the thing that the watch goes around. And then underneath all of that, you have the MagSafe charging cable sort of wrapped around at the bottom. Very elegant, very Apple-like. And it did appear that the case could possibly double as a charging stand. So the ring kind of clipped into a little area on top of the stand, and you could also almost turn it into a charging station and stand for your Apple Watch, although there's going to be a lot of third-party versions. We've already seen many of those coming out, some very elegant ones. The one from 12 South, of course, looks very, very nice. So I don't think we're going to have any shortage of options in terms of accessories for our Apple Watch. Of course, initially, you're pretty much just going to have the bands that Apple has available, but I expect third parties to actually roll their products out very, very quickly. I don't think we're going to have to be waiting too long on those. And we've also now got some of the early Apple Watch reviews. Early Apple Watch reviews came in, and they are almost all in agreement. There's a little differences between the different reviewers and things like that in terms of what specifically they liked and didn't like. But just sort of summarizing, almost all of them said this is definitely the best smartwatch we've seen to date. It's not necessarily for everyone, and it's not without its flaws. And I think that's to be expected. This is Apple's version one product, but already out of the gate, they're besting all of the competition who have been at this, you know, for a few years. So I think that's a pretty good sign. Overall, it seems like, you know, the Apple Watch is going to help you with your day-to-day interactions, your notifications, things that you might normally take your phone out of your pocket for to just look at very quickly. These aren't deep interactions, right? Apple already talked about glances and these sort of quick interactions that we do with our phone throughout the day, maybe quickly responding to a text message or an email, sending a tweet, you know, looking for bits of information like when's my next appointment, what kind of, you know, what's the weather going to be like, those sorted things that would be suited for the smaller screen on a watch, right? So you're not going to be having to take your phone out all the time. So it's going to help a lot with that. They did mention that the notifications can be a bit heavy. I guess by default, every notification that comes into your phone with a supported app is also going to be coming up on your Apple Watch, and you'll have to go through the Apple Store app or the Watch app, excuse me, to actually turn those off one by one. So there's going to be a little bit of tweaking and fine-tuning for each person to actually get it working the way you want. And that was mentioned in several of the interviews. They did say it, you know, takes a few days to kind of get that together because you need to adjust it to be personal. This is a very personal device. Apple's already talked about that. There is a little bit of a learning curve in terms of using it because you do have a number of buttons. You have the side button that brings up those social interactions, so things like the touch gestures where you can draw on it or you can send your heartbeat, that's the little button that's on the side. You have the digital crown, which allows you to scroll through things. A few of them mentioned that, you know, almost everything that you can do with the digital crown in terms of scrolling can also be replicated by swiping on the screen. The point of the digital crown being, though, that you don't obstruct the display. So playing around with that, the digital crown is also itself a button that you can push in. So a lot of different things. And that led a lot of the reviewers to say, you know, it can be a little bit tedious. It's a little bit techy. So for the average person, for non-techie, it might not be the best experience. It is a little bit technical. Overall, you know, not life-changing, but a very good experience. Now, they do say it could help with sort of the phone obsession of, you know, checking your phone all the time when you're out and about. But I think we might just be trading that for a wrist obsession. And I thought very appropriately, I think it was The Verge review pointed out that, you know, looking at your watch when you're interacting with someone is sort of the universal gesture for like, hey, I don't have time for this. I've got somewhere else to be, right? So they're going to think you're looking at your watch, checking the time like you've got the next appointment to get to, when really all you're doing is checking your text messages or your tweets. So I think this doesn't fully get past the whole, you know, social issues of being, you know, screen obsessed. It may even make it worse. We'll have to see. And then the last thing that has been mentioned in several reviews, I guess I got two more things. Battery life. Let's talk about that first. Battery life seems to be as good as advertised. So that's a good sign. Most of the reviewers saying they were able to, you know, get through a day without any issues, getting to the end of the day with 30-40% battery life. Even under heavy usage, it seemed to be able to go a full day without needing to be charged. So that's really, really good news. About the only real complaint, and one that really could hurt Apple if it's not addressed before the watch releases on the 24th, is speed issues. There seems to be several speed issues. Things like getting the screen to wake up. So, you know, when you the screen is normally off, and when you lift your wrist to look at a glance or to check the time, the screen's supposed to come on. That seems to be a little bit finicky for some users, and also it might take a second or two for it to wake up. That lessens the experience a little bit because, right, you want to be able to see the time and not have to wait 1 or 2 seconds every time you need to check your watch. So they'll have to deal with that. Also, installing apps seems to be very, very slow. Many of the reviewers pointed out that loading the actual application screen with all those little application circles or dots, the icons, that scrolling around there is pretty laggy. And I don't know if that comes from the watch being, you know, sort of underperforming or other sort of software issues. We can hope that it's software issues. And really that because all of the data has to come from your phone, certain types of data, especially things like location data, really can slow down the UI. So you'll bring up a glance, you'll bring up something where you want to get some information, and if it has to pull a lot of data from the phone, that can slow things down. So that lessens the sort of seamless experience a little bit, and I think grates on people, right? You start to notice those little nuanced bits of time. Even if they're half a second or a second, it can get a little bit annoying. So Apple did come out and say they are planning on addressing some of those speed issues. We have to remember that a lot of these reviewers were working with pre-release models, and this is pre-release version of the software. So we really need to take that part of the review, I think, with a grain of salt and wait. But if Apple doesn't get this sorted out before the 24th, I think we are going to hear about it as a problem for the Apple Watch. And again, we all need to remember this is version one of this brand new platform for Apple. So there are going to be bugs. There's going to be little weird things. Hopefully Apple can keep those minimized because, again, the bad side for Apple is everybody's watching this thing with bated breath and with a scrutiny that I think a lot of other companies wouldn't be subjected to. But overall, it's sounding like it's going to be things are going to go well. I think we're going to hear the typical complaints about the launch. There's not enough availability. It's hard to get a watch. We're going to see, I know, all those astronomical prices of devices being resold on eBay and all over the place. But in the end, I think we're going to find this is a huge success. Apple is going to sell a ton of these. It's not going to be a ton in comparison to something like the iPhone or maybe even the initial launch of the iPad, but I think it's still going to be a very successful product for Apple, and I'm looking forward to getting mine and trying it out. So that's all the latest and greatest on the Apple Watch. If you have ordered yours or you're putting your pre-order in, I hope you got the one you want, and I look forward to, you know, sharing my experiences with you when I get mine on the 24th. All right, let's talk about another one of my favorite Apple technologies, and that is Apple Pay. I am a huge fan of Apple Pay. I try and use it quite a bit. As a matter of fact, it even saved me one or two times. I'll tell you about that here in a second. But while Apple Pay seems to have a ton of support from banks and payment processors, I think they announced another 20-some-odd banks and a couple more retail locations. I think ultimately it's at the register where Apple Pay is going to win or lose. And right now, it looks like they might be losing a little bit. But currently, Apple is supported by 2,500 banks in the U.S. It's accepted at over 700,000 retail locations, but you really wouldn't know it. And as a matter of fact, B of A, Bank of America, has said that their customers have registered over 1.1 million cards, and that's for 800,000 cardholders. So there is, you know, people are using it, they're getting into it, but a recent study seems to indicate that Apple still has a lot of work to do on the retail front, at the counter, at the register. Bloomberg had reported on this survey. It was of 3,000 iPhone 6 and 6 Plus owners in a study conducted by Phoenix Marketing International. And they found that 66% of those people that they surveyed had actually added a card to Apple Pay, and that 88% of those had actually used the service. And their findings showed that at least two-thirds of the people who had actually used the service did experience some sort of issue. And I would have to include myself in that group. I've had a couple issues with Apple Pay. But overall, in the study findings, what they found was that for people who did use Apple Pay, they made 2.6 in-store transactions using the system in the first 4 months of the service being available. And of those people that used it, 50% used it to buy something from the Apple Store. 33% had used it at McDonald's. So those were kind of the two of the bigger locations where it was being used. I think also Macy's was in that list of where people were using it. And they also asked people, why do you use it? And 58% said it because they felt it was safer. And 60% said, well, just because it's a cool thing to do. It's new, it's stylish, it's cool. And, you know, there is a good feeling about using a new system like that. So I think that's a valid reason. But then they got to some of the downsides and the issues. And these are the things that could really hurt it. 48% of them said, hey, you know, at least once a few times the transaction seemed to take too long to record. I've had things like misrecording. So you think it goes, it says done, and then the transaction doesn't show up on the register. You have to kind of redo it, and then you worry about double payment. So those kinds of experiences, that doesn't happen too frequently, but it does happen. 42% said that the cashier was unfamiliar with Apple Pay and they weren't able to help with the system. And I think that's going to be a really big issue for adoption. So if you ask about Apple Pay or do you support it, and I've encountered this quite a bit too, the merchant really doesn't even know. And I've even used it several times and they say, oh, I didn't even know that worked. That's amazing. And they're usually very impressed by it. Or they'll say, I've never seen that work before. Or I've even gotten, you're the only person who ever uses that here at one of the locations where I use it frequently. So adoption and uptake is not really happening as much as I think it should be, and Apple really would want it to be. There's also been issues with transactions posting incorrectly or even being billed twice. I think that happened early on in Apple Pay, but I think most of those issues have been sorted out. But really, I think the biggest problem is there's not a lot of places accepting Apple Pay. So even though they say 700,000 locations, that ultimately is not a lot when you consider all of the retail spaces in the United States. And one of the big problems for Apple is MCX, the Merchant Customer Exchange. This is an alliance of a bunch of big name retailers like CVS, Bed Bath & Beyond, Walmart, Old Navy, Kohl's, a bunch of others, and they are trying to bring their own competing digital wallet service to market, the thing called Currency, and we've talked about that before. The thing with Currency is the main goal for these retailers, and that's why it's a conglomeration of merchants. So these aren't banks, these aren't credit card companies, these are the actual merchants. They want to reduce their credit card fees, and I think that's totally reasonable that they want to do that, but I think they're going about it in a way that I really don't like. They're trying to block our choice, block consumer choice. Basically, they want to force consumers, whether they want to or not, to use debit cards, which don't come with the same fees. And to that end, they've disabled Apple Pay and Google Wallet, basically other digital wallets on their terminals, I think in the hopes of forcing us to the other platform. For me, that just makes me want to not even try or use their platform. I'm not necessarily against debit cards, but credit cards do offer some things, especially for larger transactions. I like to use a credit card because they're better protected from fraud with federal credit card regulation and you know, insurance and things like that. Stuff that debit cards don't get the same protections on. And also, not long after announcing their service, Currency, you could sign up if you were interested in it. They had an email list. Well, they got hacked and they had their email list stolen. So you also have to worry a little bit about security. Merchants have not had a very good track record with security and protecting consumer information. The credit card companies haven't done all that well either, but they've been in the game a little bit longer and they've had to sort of put in measures and protect those things, I think, a little bit more than the end merchants have. So there's just a lot of questions about that. But really, you know, Apple needs to make sure they get signage out there, and they do now have a program. Merchants can, for free, get stickers and labels to show that they do take and support Apple Pay. I think we as consumers need to kind of demand it from the places where we buy stuff more. So I'm trying to actively more support businesses that are on Apple Pay and avoid businesses that don't support Apple Pay. I'm not being extreme about it, but if I have a choice, I will go to a Walgreens versus a CVS, or I will go to Home Depot versus Lowe's. And I'm hoping that in my small way, that makes an impact. I also, when I go to any retailer, will ask, do you support Apple Pay? And I think if they hear enough customers sort of asking for the service, that'll get up the chain and they'll say, look, we've got a lot of people who want to use Apple Pay and we don't take it. And at the end of the day, even with credit card fees, merchants want to sell stuff, right? And if having Apple Pay will help them sell more things, I think that's enough motivation to get them to implement it. But Apple needs to do some stuff on their side, I think, as well. Maybe do some education programs for especially some of their larger partners and retailers with their clerks and things like that, so that the experience is also great when a customer goes in to use Apple Pay. So hopefully they're working on that stuff, and I think it'll only get better over time. Currency should be coming out pretty soon, so it'll be interesting to see how consumers take to that or don't take to that. To me, the whole system sounds cumbersome. They're using like QR codes, and it seems like it's not going to be nearly as seamless as Apple Pay or even Google Wallet is. So I think consumers are probably going to choose the easier route, but only time will tell. As I mentioned earlier, the MacBook is also going to be here tomorrow on April 10th. I don't know how supply and availability is going to be on the MacBook. We haven't heard too much about that. I have a feeling you'll be able to go into an Apple store and actually buy a MacBook if you want to do that. You can also, of course, order them online starting tomorrow. And we did start to see some unboxings. A Vietnamese site landed a unit somehow and did a little unboxing video. The images have since been taken down, so I think that adds some legitimacy to the fact that it was a real MacBook, and it looked very, very nice. And so in addition to that, we've also seen some benchmarking. A lot of people are questioning the performance of the new MacBook because it does have those new Intel Core M processors running at lower clock speeds. The entry-level MacBook is a 1.1 gigahertz, and we got to see some Geekbench numbers on it. It came in with a Geekbench score of around 2,000 for single-core performance and 4,200 for multi-core. That's about 1,000 points under the 2015 MacBook Air, which has a 1.6 gigahertz Intel Core i5 processor. That machine, the MacBook Air, scored 2,881 on single-core and 5,757 on multi-core. So it is slower than the current MacBook Air. Another way of sort of putting it into perspective is it pretty much has the same performance as the top-of-the-line 2011 MacBook Air. So that's a four-year-old MacBook Air. That one had a 1.8 gigahertz Core i7 processor, though. So the 1.1 gigahertz Core M coming in equivalent to a 2011 1.8 gigahertz Core i7 processor. So You know, I don't think it's horrible. It's not going to be the speediest MacBook out there, but it's certainly probably the sexiest, and it definitely is the thinnest and lightest one out there. And keep in mind also, those Geekbench scores, they do not measure things like GPU, and the new MacBook is going to have a GPU that's far better than what was in the 2011 MacBook Air, and it also has the faster flash memory. So the storage on there is running at a faster speed as well. So those things are going to help bump it up. So it'll be interesting when we can actually compare them to the 2011 MacBook Air in GPU performance and some of the other factors that we want to track. I think ultimately it comes down to real-world performance for people. And if you just need a machine that's going to do email and Word documents and Pages documents, and you're not doing a lot of high-end photos and video, I mean, it's going to do iPhoto just fine. It'll do iMovie. You might have to wait a little bit longer than you would if you were using it on a you know, older MacBook Pro, something like that. But I think for a lot of people, it's going to be a really, really nice machine. And there was an Apple retailer who leaked information that there may be a third processor option that Apple hasn't mentioned, maybe in the build to order. You might be able to get it with a 1.3 gigahertz processor. That leaked information did have pricing. The MacBook comes in 256 gigabytes of storage and 512 gigabytes of flash storage. So the price, if you want to get the 1.3 gigahertz model, is rumored to be $1,584 US for the 256 or $1,748 for the 512. Now, those numbers are a little bit weird, so I'm taking them with a grain of salt, because I would think it would be $1,599 and $1,799 respectively, but who knows? That was what was reported in that rumor. And then just one last thing on updates. We talked a little bit about an iPhone 6C possibly coming out in the next round of iPhones, a 4-inch model basically of the current iPhone 6. New pictures showed up and alleged that the case, last time we saw photos that said the iPhone 6C was still going to have the plastic case. But this week, we got a conflicting report. This from a French smartphone case maker. They reportedly had a casing or a back case for an iPhone 6C, and it was the same kind of metal design as the current iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. And it did show the oval True Tone flash as well as the dual speaker grills at the bottom, so it seemed to match that design. Now, when we see these things, there's a lot of this stuff that comes out of China that are just fakes or knockoffs or, you know, different models. So I don't put a lot of stock in the actual images. Some of the rumors and information, though, you know, a lot of times those fakes are made off of leaked information that does turn out to be legitimate. So we don't totally discount them, but I always take them with a grain of salt. I think last time we talked a bit about Apple's rumored streaming TV service. It's been reported that Apple is trying to line up content deals right now, and they're hoping to release a new streaming TV option in the fall for around $30 to $40 a month, seems to be what they're targeting. They're trying to line up partners directly, so they're going directly to the content providers, companies like Disney and ABC. And this week, we got a little more information on how the service might work and what Apple's asking their partners to do. One of the things they're asking for is that the content partners provide their own streams. Now, this isn't really that unusual. It was sort of reported as like this was a big deal, Apple saying, hey, you got to provide your own stream. But it's actually something the providers already do with their existing iPhone and Apple TV apps. So we have a lot of this content on demand on Apple TV. If you have a cable subscription, you can opt into it. And those streams are already being provided. So it really isn't that weird. Also, the costs for it, I guess, aren't too bad. I read one report that said it costs the providers about 5 cents per hour per stream. So not a lot to stream that stuff. But still, maybe some of the smaller providers that Apple's talking to who aren't already doing this stuff, that might be a little bit of a hindrance for them. They might not be ready, and especially considering the demand that might ramp up from Apple's TV service. So they could see a huge influx of stress on their current streaming systems as a lot of Apple TV customers sign up for the new service. So that may be something that's factoring into some of the negotiations, but Eddie Q has basically said, you know, and he's the guy negotiating these deals. He has said that he feels that Apple should really stay focused on the hardware and software and the customer front end, customer experience side of things. And then these guys who, you know, do streaming, this is their content. They've been in that side of the business. They have people or companies that they work with to provide these kinds of services. They should focus on that side of the business. And I think that actually makes a lot of sense. Some have also said that Apple might be concerned if they host the streams themselves that they would be subject to the kind of throttling from broadband providers that companies like Netflix were faced with, right? Netflix has had to actually pay extra to companies like Comcast and some of these others to actually ensure that their streams and their data can flow quickly. And Apple's service would definitely be looked at as a competitive service to companies like Comcast and Verizon, and they may not want Apple, you know, running through their system, so they might try to throttle them and extort them for money. That seems like a more legitimate reason for Apple to kind of want the content providers to take on that part of the business. So I'm thinking, you know, both these things are sort of factoring in. Another thing that we heard from the street this week was that Apple and Disney are at odds over their content. And that's interesting because I think Disney's Bob Iger is on Apple's board. And Apple has always had a pretty good relationship with Disney when it comes to content. But apparently Disney wants Apple, if they're going to bring their services to the Apple TV streaming service, to pay for all of their different content channels. And they have a ton of different ones, but Apple is trying to keep their costs down, and they're saying they want to kind of pick the specific ones that, like, they have channels that are family targeted and family oriented. Apple might want those, but they might not want some of the others. They might specifically want things like ESPN for sports, and they don't want to have to pay for everything because that would drive the cost up and might put their final price point for the monthly streaming service higher than they want. So hopefully they can work those sorts of things out. And if Apple does get the streaming service out, we've also heard that there might finally be an update to the Apple TV hardware. And one of the things that was being thrown around as a possible new feature was that it would come with support for 4K content. But it's sounding now like that may not be the case, at least according to BuzzFeed News. Apple's latest A8 system on a chip was found to be capable of actually outputting 4K video, and it's assumed an updated Apple TV would feature at least an A8 chip, if not something better. But the thing is if you really think about it, 4K right now really is pretty much a niche kind of product. There's not a lot of providers or even television sets that support 4K. It brings with it a lot of bandwidth issues. I am thinking I had problems when Netflix just went to HD streams, you know, 3 megabit per second HD streams. And I think their 4K streams run at 16 megabits per second. So that's more than five times the bandwidth of the HD stream. And I also have a data cap on my cable service, so I can only pull down so much content per month. I think the default is 250 gigabytes per month. I've upped mine, I think, to 300 gigabytes per month or 400 gigabytes per month. But you start pushing that much content through, you know, people's broadband connections, and you're going to start capping out really, really quickly. So I think, you know, the infrastructure and the content just isn't there to support the need for 4K. So that's probably not going to happen. And then finally, on, you know, an unrelated report, not related to Apple TV or TV streaming, more to the iMac, but still on this idea of chasing the K's, there was a report and a rumor from Apple Insider that LG leaked in a press release that Apple had an upcoming 8K iMac, because they mentioned Apple shipping an 8K iMac later this year. That would be nuts. I have heard nothing about 8K displays. I know we have the 5K iMac, and it's looking like, according to LG, what happened was they had just simply had a typo. Someone actually typoed and put 8 instead of 5 on that press release. I think they do have some 8K displays, but I would imagine those showing up in really high-end television sets that cost tens of thousands of dollars initially. And it might be a while before we actually see that in an iMac. Maybe we should get to 6 or 7K before we just jump all the way straight up to 8K. But I don't know. Maybe 8K makes more sense because it's double 4K. I don't follow that thing. I somewhat feel like the whole K race is following the megahertz race and all these other things. But, you know, how much data and pixels can the human eye really see? I don't know. I don't understand the science of it, so maybe I'm just talking crazy. You let me know. And then finally in the news for this week, we've got a couple of software updates that dropped over the last couple days. macOS 10.10.3 and iOS 8.3. The big news on 10.10.3 is the Photos app. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. I'll give you some hints and tips and tricks related to photos. We also got 300 new emoji, including those diversified emoji icons. And also, I guess they have support for the Vulcan salute icon, the live long and prosper, you know, Spock hand. But there's a trick in getting to that. It's supported, but they actually don't have it in the little list. So you're going to have to go find it online in a text or in a tweet or something like that, copy, and then set up a shortcut on your iOS device so that you can actually type it out. But if you send it to someone who's running iOS 8.3, it will display correctly. If you send it to someone who is on an older device who hasn't updated their operating system yet, it will show up as a little box, or it sounds like a little alien head or something like that. So that's what it maps to in the character set in the Unicode. But you have those new emoji, and then also there are a number of bug fixes that address things like Wi-Fi issues, Bluetooth, screen sharing, and Safari. And then iOS 8.3, this one is a pretty big update. A lot of bug fixes and things like that in there. You now have Passbook Passes and Apple Pay are separated in the user interface. Siri can now make speakerphone calls. So if you activate Siri, you can say, make a speakerphone call to or call so-and-so on speaker, and she will automatically enable the speakerphone. Siri also got more language support. So you now have Siri in Brazil, Denmark, India, Netherlands, New Zealand, Russia, Sweden, Thailand, and Turkey. The space bar on the portrait display, especially when you're doing the web keyboard that has the little period, that has been elongated to prevent you from accidentally hitting the period when you want to hit a space. Thank Zeus on this one, because I do this all the time. I was running the iOS 8.3 beta and it was short. I think they just lengthened it because it was really, really short and I kept hitting the period every time I wanted to type a space, and it was so annoying I'd have to go back. So hopefully that issue is behind me. They also now give you the option to download free apps without a password. A note on this one, in order to see this option, if you have an iPhone 6 or a 6 Plus, you need to not be running Touch ID for iTunes purchases. So if you already have it set up so that you can make an iTunes purchase with Touch ID, and you want to be able to use this, you know, download things for free without a password, you need to disable Touch ID. So just be aware of that. There's also then the usual bug fixes and improvements, although it was reported that some people are experiencing a new bug after updating. Some people are reporting that, you know, for devices that do have Touch ID and have Touch ID enabled for purchases on iTunes, that does not seem to be working for some people after upgrading. I think mine is working, so I don't think I had this issue, but iMore claims they kind of figured out a fix for it. And it basically amounts to disabling Touch ID for purchases and then rebooting your device and then turning it back on. So, you know, go into the settings, into Touch ID and passcode, enter your passcode or password to get in there, toggle the iTunes and App Store to off for Touch ID, so turn that off, then go back to the home screen, reboot your iPhone or iPad, then log back in, launch settings, go into Touch ID and passcode, enter your password, and turn iTunes and App Store back on. And supposedly resetting all of that will fix your Touch ID issue. So if you've run into that, that's how you fix it. And then along with the OS 10 10.3 and iOS 8.3 updates, Apple also did release an update to iTunes on the Mac, 12.1.2. It brings in support for syncing photos to your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch from the new Photos app that is available in OS 10 10.3. And then also brings in several refinements to the Get Info window. As well as improves the overall stability of iTunes. So if you haven't grabbed the software updates yet, you'll probably want to do that. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, an email this week, I had a MacCast listener who emailed me about a Craigslist purchase of an iPhone. His daughter purchased an iPhone, and it turned out to be stolen, which was really unfortunate. Luckily, he let me know in the email also that they were able to get their money back. The seller was apologetic, so I'm not sure all the details in there, but it turned out okay. And in the end, I guess they still had the stolen iPhone and wanted to try and get it back to the original owner if possible. And tried talking to Apple, tried talking to T-Mobile and Verizon, tried talking even to the police to see if there was any way of getting this back to the original owner, and they actually had no luck in returning it. So the question was, you know, how can we potentially find this person? Is there any way? Can you think of anything? And I really couldn't think of anything to do beyond maybe doing some Googling on the serial number in the hopes that maybe they posted the serial number or the IMEI number in a forum or something like that, saying, hey, I had this stolen. Here's my phone. If you come across it, let me know. But beyond that, I can't really think of anything. Because it was device locked, I'm guessing that the owner at some point originally had it on Find My iPhone. So my hope for you would be that ultimately they'll activate Find My iPhone and send a message and you'll be able to get it returned to them. I think the frustration was, is, you know, why can't we get any help from Apple or the police? But I think, you know, Apple really doesn't want to get involved, probably from a whole legal standpoint. It probably gets really weird. Plus, they'd be inundated with kind of tracking down these people. And I, you know, on the police, I'm not really sure what they could do, how they could actually help you find the owner. But, you know, Find My iPhone is a really good thing, and I really encourage you, if you're not using it on your device, that you do consider using it. And it's really easy to set up. On the device itself, you just tap settings and then tap on iCloud. You'll be asked to sign in. You enter your Apple ID. If you don't already have one, you can get one for free, and the instructions are right there. And then just, you know, flip on the Find My iPhone option, turn it to green, and then your phone will be protected. And if you lose it or it gets stolen, you'll have some options to actually try and recover it, including sending a message so that if a good Samaritan like this listener finds it, they can get it back to you. And you can also set it up on the Mac, very similar process. You go into System Preferences, go to iCloud, sign into your iCloud account, and turn Find My Mac on. So that's for your Mac versus your iOS device, but I definitely recommend you using it. Now, getting back to purchasing a used iPhone, I know you're going to have trouble getting it back, you know, the stolen iPhone back to the original owner now that you have it. But before making your purchase in the future, if you want to hopefully avoid accidentally buying a stolen iPhone, there are some things that you can do. Apple actually has a site that you can go to, iCloud.com/activationlock, and you can check and see if a phone that you might want to buy is activation locked. You will need the device's IMEI number or the serial number, so you would have to ask the buyer, or the seller rather, to provide that to you. If they're not willing to provide that to you, I would be a little bit wary and maybe not make that purchase. Or if they're saying, I can give that to you when I meet you or something like that, if they're just a little bit worried about the transaction themselves, because, you know, that concern goes both ways, then there are some things you could do to check the device when you actually go to pick it up. One thing I would recommend is, if you're planning on activating it on a new carrier, and maybe you're transferring a SIM from an old phone, bring that SIM or that phone with you so you can swap it out. And that'll make the process a little bit easier. But you want to make sure that the device that you're purchasing has been completely erased and restored. So it shouldn't have anything on it, shouldn't have any of the old data. The person you're buying it from should be able to log into it if it's passcode locked. If they can't, that's a huge red flag, right? But you want to make sure that it's been restored and that it's not connected to any Find My iPhone or iCloud account. So you're going to want to have the person that you're buying it from unlock the device or open and unlock the device if it's locked. Go into the settings and confirm that it's not set up with an iCloud account and that Find My iPhone is not on. If those things are on, ask them to turn them off and then ask them to go into the settings down to reset, all the way down to reset, and ask them to press the button to completely erase and restore the device. So get it totally wiped out and reset. Do that after it has been disconnected from iCloud and Find My iPhone. So once they've done that, you should be good to go. And then once it reboots and it's been erased, then go ahead and see if you can set up the device. You should be able to go through the setup process, choose your language and country, pop your SIM in there, connect it to a network, let the device activation begin, and that'll prove that it's not activation locked. If you are asked for the previous owner's Apple ID or password, then the device is still linked to their account, and you need to hand it back to them and say you need to disable all this stuff. So, and if they're not there, if you're doing it over the phone, they can actually do that stuff remotely by going to iCloud.com/find. So really don't take ownership of that device if it hasn't been totally reset and erased and disconnected. The key important factor is that it's disconnected from Find My iPhone, because I think that's the thing that mainly controls the activation lock. So hopefully that'll help you out in the future if you're in the market for a used iPhone. I know over the years I have covered this, but Joe recently asked me if I would talk again about my podcast workflow. And I think it has been quite a while since we covered it in total. I think I've done bits and pieces here and there. I've also talked about it on some of their podcasts. So you may have heard some of this information before, but there's probably some things that are updated in here as well. And if you're considering doing a podcast or just generally interested in it, I'm happy to go over it again. So Joe, here's what's going on. I start each week or each, you know, the lead up to each show with research and organizing. That's actually probably the bulk of what I do for the podcast. It encompasses probably 20, 30 hours in total. I don't do it all at once. It's not like I sit down for 20 hours or, well, you can do that, you know, for 2 days at 10 hours a day and do it. I'm doing this on a daily basis. I'm throwing things together. And I do have a system and a process for it. So really the only way I could get through it all would be to use RSS feeds. So I'm not visiting a bunch of different websites. I've got all their RSS feeds lined up, all the, you know, major Mac news sites, and I have different apps, different RSS readers that I use on my Macs and different devices. I used to use the Reader app exclusively across everything, but there were some delays when they were making the transition from Google's RSS service, and I found some other tools that I liked better on different platforms and stuff like that. But really the key to being able to work cross-platform with the RSS feeds for me is a service called Feedly. And that's the thing that keeps all of my browsing and reading in sync. Because what I do is each day I go through and I just basically parse the RSS feeds, because I'm not going to cover every story. There's a lot of non-Apple related stories that show up in the feeds. I don't do a lot of individual app coverage. Those sorts of stories I throw out. I don't like, as many of you know, to talk about a lot of the lawsuit stuff unless it's absolutely necessary. So I kind of skip over those. So I do this parse through, and basically what I'm doing is I'm going through and I'm finding the articles that I think I want to talk about, and I'm just starring them. So it's like my first pass through the articles. And I do that throughout the week. I'll read a few here and there to kind of get caught up on things. But really what I'm doing is marking stuff to come back to later. And Feedly helps keep that in sync. So if I'm out, you know, waiting in line at the store, I can parse through a couple of feeds, star a few of them, and collect them all together. So I'm collecting articles that I'm going to want to cover. And then I'm going to come back later in the day or maybe a couple days later and actually start reading through those articles. And that's when I'm going to start putting together the show notes for the show. And this is really an ongoing active process. So I'm putting stuff into show notes. finding new stuff. I'm going back and adjusting things as new information comes out, because a big thing I try and do on the MacCast, as you know, is not just come from one source or one angle on a story, but really try and balance it all out, get you as much information as I possibly can, kind of aggregate this stuff for you. Because you could, of course, go out and go to all these different sites and do it yourself, but it's a lot of work, right? So I'm hoping to take that off, and then you can just listen to the show and get caught up, and you're getting the totality of the information, and hopefully, you know, as close to up-to-date as I can get it. We try our best. But so the process for doing that is sort of bringing these feeds together, getting bits and pieces from here and there, and building an aggregate picture of each story that I want to do. And that is how that process works. So then that's going into my show notes. And for show notes, I use Omni Outliner. So I'm going through those starred stories, and I'm picking out the bullet points that I want to talk about, and I'm putting those into Omni Outliner. And again, I need to work cross-platform. So I will work on my iPad. I generally don't do a lot of the note stuff on my iPhone, but in a pinch, I can do it. And when working with Omni Outliner to keep everything in sync, I use their sync service. So they have a free service called Omni Sync Server, and that is built in, support for that is built into their apps through what's called Omnipresence. And they actually have an Omnipresence app that you run on the Mac. It works very similar to a service like Dropbox, where it creates an Omnipresence folder. I put my show note files in there, and then those files are available to my iOS devices, and it syncs everything up. So if I make a change on one, it syncs it back to the Mac on the other. And then I also use Omni Outliner when I go to create the show notes for the website, because it has some great export options. I can export all the HTML that I upload to the server and link to from the show notes at maccast.com. Also the OPML versions, which is the outline markup language. I forget what the P stands for. Outline something markup language. It's a standard for doing outlines, and you can actually take that OPML file and pull it back into Omni Outliner or any other OPML supported app and actually parse through the show notes and do whatever you want with them. So that is something that comes from the early days of podcasting. I don't think a lot of people even produce those files or support that anymore, but it was big for us when we started podcasting. As a matter of fact, the original podcast directory, if we can call it that, was this fragmented system. Everybody kind of maintained a node. I actually did the computer and technology node. I think Adam Curry had the master file that linked off to all the different categories and things like that. And it was just a series of OPML files that were linked together. So a little podcast history for you there, got off on a little tangent. But I use Omni Outliner to export that stuff. And occasionally, if I'm doing some special kind of episodes or segments or stuff like that, I might take some show notes in Markdown. I just use text files in Markdown using the Byword app. And I use Dropbox to keep those files in sync. And then I'll just eventually pull those back into my Omni Outliner outline. And if you want to see what the show notes look like I said, they're available on the website. Pretty much what you see, even in the HTML version with the disclosure triangles and the bullet points, that is the actual thing that I'm looking at as I'm actually sitting down to record the show. So let's talk about the next phase. So I got all the show notes together and I'm ready to sit down and start recording. Before I talk about the kind of the process of recording, let's talk a little bit about the equipment. A lot of people want to know the ins and outs, the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty, the gear, for you gearheads. And I use, for my main microphone in my studio, an Audio-Technica AT2020. It is an XLR condenser microphone, so it uses your standard, little 3-pin microphone connector. It's not a USB microphone. Some people will use USB microphones connected right into your Mac. I think that is a little bit easier, and Audio-Technica does make a USB version of this same mic, the AT2020, if you want to go that route. But I have the more traditional XLR connectors because I do all of my actual processing of my voice and stuff like that externally. I use a DBX 286A mic preamp processor. It's been discontinued. It's an older unit. They now make one. It's called the 286S. model, and that's pretty much the same thing. And the main reason I have that is because I don't have a traditional studio. I'm was originally in an extra bedroom in my house, and there was a lot of room noise. There was like hum from the air conditioner, you know, it's just that general room noise. If you listen to your rooms, they're never completely silent, right? Just sit in a quiet room and listen, and you'll hear all the little noises that go on in the background. And they're very low, but I wanted something that could cut that out. And so what this unit has is what's called a noise gate. So I can set a threshold, and any noises that are below a certain level will not get picked up by the system. So it has it for that, but then it also has things like a compressor limiter, has something called a de-esser, which takes some of the harshness out of S sounds. So it just helps clean things up. And I don't run it really heavy, as you probably can tell. I don't do a lot of extra processing. I don't crank up, you know, the low levels or anything like that. I try and keep it as natural sounding as possible. So really, that unit is just there to kind of filter and clean up the sound as much as possible because of the rooms I'm kind of recording in. I don't have a formal, you know, official recording studio with the sound dampening and stuff like that. Although I now am in a closet and I use my Gorilla sound dampening, which is packing blankets just hung a few inches away from the wall, which actually works quite well. As you can tell, it sounds pretty good in here. It's almost like having a recording booth in a way. And then that is all run into, because I have to get it in the Mac because I'm using analog gear, right? So I have to get it into a digital signal. So I'm using a USB audio interface. In this case, it's actually the same thing that's my portable recorder for when I'm out in the field, and that is a Zoom H4n handy recorder. And then that plugs into the Mac via USB, and then I just use GarageBand, which recognizes that USB, you know, recognizes the whole system basically as a USB mic, and then I can use that as my sound input. And then I monitor the whole thing directly off of the Zoom as well. So I'm not listening to the signal on the Mac because that can have some delay. I'm actually, you know, hearing that directly. I'm hearing exactly what's coming from the mic and going into the computer right before it goes into the computer. So that's my studio setup. Like I said, I have a mobile setup. So when I'm out doing interviews, like when I do my Macworld interviews, I'm using my Zoom H4 handy recorder, which has XLR inputs on the bottom. And with that, I use a specific interview mic. It's called the Sennheiser MD46. It was actually developed for NBC to do their interviews at the Olympics. I think the Olympic Games in Torino, it was developed for. And what's great about that is it really cuts out anything but the interview noise. It's very directional, cuts out what they call handling noise. So if I'm grabbing the mic, you're not going to hear my fingers, you know, sort of shifting on the mic and stuff like that. It is an excellent mic. Runs about, I think, $200. So it's not inexpensive, but it was worth it for me to get that quality sound when I was out at the trade floor. You know, really cuts out any noise. I can be in a really noisy booth and it will just sound like a low drone or hum in the background, nice background noise. And that's done without having to do any processing. You know, I'm really about trying to capture the good sound without having to do a lot of post-processing, a lot of filters and stuff like that in GarageBand. A lot of stuff you can do in software. I've just chosen, I think, to have hardware do it because I think it's easier. So I kind of went the easy route. I know a lot of guys that do great stuff with software, though, and our computers are more than capable of handling that. And then most recently, I added to my mobile rig because I want to be able to potentially just take an iPad or an iPhone and record from those on occasion. So Dave Hamilton over at Mac Observer told me about the Audio-Technica AT2005 USB, which is this great little portable USB dynamic microphone. So it's pretty rugged. It is going to have great sound. And what's cool about this one is it has both USB and XLR built into it. So you can plug it into traditional equipment or go directly into the computer or your iPad via USB using the Lightning to USB adapter. So I can connect that in, fire up GarageBand, and record directly on that. So if I'm in a hotel room or in a more remote location where I don't want to have to carry around a bunch of gear, I can do that. And so that kind of covers all the equipment I am actually currently using. And I'll have links to all of this stuff in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you didn't get all that, just review there and you can link off and you can find all of this gear and specifically the models and stuff like that. And then, like I said, the software, I am using GarageBand. I'm still using GarageBand 11. That's version 6.0.5. And that is the old version because in the newer version, they've removed the podcast track, which is what I use to do all of the enhanced podcasts, to add the chapters and chapter markers and the album art and all that sort of stuff. That's been removed, but it still works in OS X Yosemite. I'm hoping it's going to work a lot longer, because the minute they take it away, I think that is the end of the enhanced podcast, unfortunately, because I don't know of any other really easy way to build it. I know there's some other software out there, but I haven't been really happy with the editing workflow on that. So that's how I do it. And when I sit down to actually record the show, I do it, you know, some people do live recording. I do what I call semi-live recording or live editing. So I sit down and I am recording the show, and I will talk as much as I can live until I make a flub or a mistake. And then I will stop if need be, go back to where I made the mistake, and just find a good entry point and re-record over that part and try and keep going forward. So in the past, when I first started doing this, I tried just recording all the way through with mistakes and all, and then going back and editing out the mistakes. But some of those would occasionally get left in. I would miss them. So that wasn't a really good workflow for me. It also took a very long time. It was a lot more time in editing. So I've just found over the years, it's easier to go back and just fix that mistake almost in line and then keep moving forward. And occasionally you might be able to hear it, but hopefully I've done a good enough job in finding the edit points and stuff like that, that you're not really going to notice those flubs. So yes, sometimes it sounds like this is very natural, but there is a little bit of editing. And I've gotten better over the years. There used to be a lot of editing. Now I can go, you know, a pretty good distance without making those mistakes. So we try and do it that way as much as possible. So then I get all the recording in. I stitch everything kind of together so I can move it around in the timeline as I'm going along, again, in that whole live editing, what I'm calling the live editing fashion. And I'm not an editor. So probably if you're an audio editor out there, you're going, oh, Adam, what are you doing? You're doing it all wrong. But you know, I don't come from that audio background. I've just figured this on the fly. This is guerrilla podcasting. So I get done, and then I add in my chapter markers and links using the podcast track and GarageBand for that. That's really easy. And then you just drop in, you drag and drop in the artwork. You put in your URLs in the little fields. You know, it's really just filling out form fields at the bottom. And then that is the show. And then I just go ahead and export it. Because another thing that this version of GarageBand has is it has where you can export to a file. And I export directly to an audio file. I don't go into iTunes. I think with the new version, I'd have to export directly into iTunes. I don't like doing that. So I'll export the MP3 and the AAC version. And then I have to bring those into iTunes to add the metadata. So I bring those in, I add all the tags, I add the titles, all that stuff that you see in iTunes, and then those are the audio files. And then I'll drag those out of iTunes to export them to my desktop. And then I have to put together the RSS feed. I still kind of do my RSS feed by hand. I'm not actually writing the XML in the RSS feed. I use an application called Feeder, which will help me put in all the iTunes tags, the descriptions, all of the show information that you're going to see when you're picking it up in iTunes. A great piece of software. Again, something that I've used for years, but I am really kind of handcrafting and fine-tuning that stuff. There's ways to automate that. I've just never moved to that sort of system because I like the finite control that I get from using the Feeder application. And then the Feeder application does handle pushing those files up to my server via FTP. It also will create the shell of the blog post that goes up on maccast.com. I'll need to go back into maccast.com and then clean that up. That runs on WordPress, for those of you who are curious. So I go into WordPress. I have to put in the little code for the web audio player and all that sort of stuff. And then it's pretty much good to go. Oh, the audio files, as far as where those are hosted, I originally hosted those on Libsyn. Since joining Backbeat Media and having them handle the advertising, we now do the hosting over on CashFly. But you knew that, right? Because you listened to the show. So love the guys at CashFly. They do a great job making sure our audio is out there and accessible to you, and we can get it to everybody who wants to get it. So that's really about handling the volume. And Libsyn's great at that too, but either of those services you can go with. And I use both of them. They're both great. So that's pretty much it. That's how the show gets out to you. That's how it gets produced. If you have any more questions about that, you want me to go into more detail on anything, be sure to let me know. I'm happy to do that. I can respond to you on email. But hopefully that sort of lays it out for everybody. And if you're in podcasting already, you probably knew a lot of that stuff. Everybody has a kind of different system, too. I'm not saying mine is the right way or the best way or anything like that. That's just the system I've come up with over doing this for 10 years. So there you have it. Since Apple kind of announced the migration from iPhoto to the Photos application, many of us have been waiting for that to be released. A lot of people have been wondering, what's the experience going to be like? How's it going to be? And we've heard a little bit over the last couple months because Apple put out the betas and the public betas. We started to get inklings of how the Photos application would work. It's now out officially, so you can get it if you upgrade to iOS 10.10.3. You will get the Photos application. So I wanted to go into some maybe quick tips, some things that I found out in using it, because I have been using it since the beta, and just give you some things that you probably should know about it and maybe answer some of the first initial questions that you might have. So when you first launch the Photos app, it's going to either auto-convert your main iPhoto library or ask you to pick a library that you want to import into the Photos application. So a lot of people were curious, you know, what happens to my iPhoto library? Good news is that when it does the import, you do get to keep your iPhoto library. So it's not going to tweak anything. It's actually going to import and kind of copy everything over. And I'm kind of caveating that because it copies it, but in a really creative way. So that it doesn't eat up all the storage on your Mac. Because, you know, as you know, iPhoto libraries can be pretty big. And in case you're wondering what happens from a technical standpoint, is that in essence, it brings everything over and then creates symbolic links within your old iPhoto library to point to the master files. So none of the master original files are duplicated, and that really cuts down on the storage. And it also allows you to continue to use iPhoto or Aperture. They're not removed from your system, so you're not fully tied into having to completely migrate over from day one. So if you fire up Photos and it's just confusing, you don't like it, you can go back to using iPhoto or Aperture. The iPhoto or the Photos library and the iPhoto Aperture Universal library, though, those are kept separate. You will have the two separate files. You'll see them separately. It even does, if you select it and get info on the, I'm just going to go with iPhoto because that's what I use, the old iPhoto library. And this got me at first, and I actually made what I think now is a mistake. I looked at the what was called the, I think they renamed it iPhoto, iPhoto library.archive, or I forget, they changed the name a little bit. But when I looked at that, it looked like it was still my full iPhoto library in size. It looks from the Finder like it was duplicated, but it's not because of how the links underlying work. So you really don't know it, but it's kind of pointing to the masters that are in the new photo library. And I then decided, well, I want to move that off. So I archived the old iPhoto library, and then I deleted it off my main hard drive. But I really didn't need to do that because it's not using up really an extra space. So you can keep both of those there. You don't have to do it. If it really bugs you, you can also delete it and just work with Photos. But I'll let you make the call on that. And another thing that gets asked a lot is, you know, I have multiple iPhoto libraries. Can I use this opportunity with Photos to merge them? You can create, import, and open multiple photo libraries with Photos, but they still, just like before, stay as separate libraries. There is no merging functionality. So you can't take two iPhoto libraries and then merge them together in Photos, at least not out of the box. I don't know if some of the tools we've used in the past, iPhoto Library Manager and those sorts of things, will work with Photos. I haven't checked or verified that, but hopefully those tools will still work and you will be able to use them. When you do the import, one change you'll notice immediately is that Photos doesn't have the concept of events. So all of your events are going to now be put into albums. You'll have a special album called iPhoto Events, and they will be labeled with the events names. So they're all still there, but Photos takes on, just like the Photos app on iOS, this idea of collections, moments, those sorts of things. So you will drill down in there. And so to that end, I would say the navigation is very much like iOS is. So if you're used to the Photos app in iOS, you're going to be pretty familiar with sort of the navigation structure and how things work in Photos on the Mac. To me, it's very browser-like. The forward and backward buttons in the menu bar up in the upper left-hand corner are really going to be your friend. And this was a hard concept for me. I really got confused because as you look at your photo library and your photos, you kind of have to drill down. So you double-click on something in a year, and that goes into the collection view, and then you double-click on something in a collection, and that goes into the moments, and then you double-click on the moments, and then you get your image. And to back out of that, you have to use the back button. So you back, just like you're navigating through a browser. And so if you keep that in mind, you're going to have a much better time sort of working your way through the Photos application. One thing that constantly confused me is when you're looking at a collection or a moment, it has the little title bar, which also displays the location because they're sort of sorted by date and location. And clicking on that will bring up the map view. And so I was constantly going into the map view, trying to think that I was maybe going to go back or something like that. Just know if you want to see the map location view, click on the title area where the little location is written. Otherwise, use the back button. And then another feature that I really liked in iPhoto was faces. That's another thing that has been moved into the albums area. Now, when you're browsing through your photos, you can turn on the little labels to show faces and stuff like that on your photos. But really, if you want to see that faces view, you have to go into the faces album. And it has a cool design. It's got, that sort of circle motif that's going to be more and more familiar, I think, when the Apple Watch comes out. And there are also all kinds of special albums for things like panoramas, videos, slow-mo, time lapses, and bursts. So all those different kinds of photos you take with your iPhone, those specialized ones, those get automatically separated into special albums as well. So the albums area is where a lot of stuff is. Photos is going to be your main photo library. And by default, it's got that one window interface. So everything shows up as a tab. There is no sidebar, but I'm going to tell you a little trick about that sidebar here in a minute. But, well, actually, let's just jump to the sidebar now. I'm going to go out of order a little bit from my show notes. So the sidebar, if you want to get that back and you want to see your albums and your projects and all that stuff in the sidebar again, it hasn't gone away. It's just hidden. So you can go under the view menu and choose show sidebar or just hit Option Command S. And that will bring the sidebar back. It'll get rid of the tabs, and it'll be a little more familiar view. So that might be a good view to take in if you're having trouble transitioning. And then the info window. This is another big change. So in iPhoto, if you're browsing through and you click on Edit or the info window, you have that little panel that was sort of locked in the lower right-hand corner. I think that's where it was. It's now back to a standard floating palette. So if you go under the window menu and choose info or just hit Command I, the get info shortcut, you're going to get this little floating window. And it's in there where you'll find things like the, title, date, whether it's favorited or not, a lot of that metadata information, all your camera EXIF data or EXIF. I always say EXIF. Is it EXIF or EXIF? EXIF data. I knew I was going to get that right eventually. And then your descriptions and your keywords, any faces that are attached, the location, basically all that metadata for the photo that you're currently viewing is going to be in that little floating palette. And that one's a little bit tricky for me as well because I keep losing that palette as it's floating around. I think I kind of liked it having it be attached in that sort of multi-frame format. But I think as Apple has moved to more of this one window idea, they decided that just didn't work. So that's how you get to get info. Now, another big thing that the Photos app brings is the iCloud photo library. And I'm probably going to have to, I haven't used it yet, so I'm not able to get really in depth on it. And I know you have a lot of questions about it. I have a lot of questions about it myself, and I'm going to try and dig into it more and hopefully cover some things on future episodes. But just in the reading and some of the stuff that I have discovered, I wanted to let you know a few things. If you enable iCloud photo library, All of your photos, copies of all your photos, the original photos, are going to be put up into iCloud, and they are going to count against your iCloud storage. That's the biggest thing to know. So if you have a huge iCloud or a photo library, rather, just be aware of that. It's going to push all that stuff, or try to push all that stuff, into your iCloud account. So you're probably going to need to buy additional storage. Your free account only comes with 5 gigabytes of storage. Most people I know have photo libraries that are much, much larger than that. Apple doesn't have the cheapest storage costs, but they're not too bad. It's $1 a month for 20 gigabytes. And again, these are the U.S. prices, so adjust accordingly for your country. $4 for 200 gigabytes, $10 for 500 gigabytes, and $20 a month for a terabyte. So these are monthly prices. So just be prepared if you want to put that stuff up there. And there could be some good reasons to do that, right? You'll have access to all of your photos from multiple machines. In a way, it's a sort of backup. More on that in a second, because there's one thing about that that I kind of don't like, being a big proponent of doing backups. But just be aware of that if you're going to enable the iCloud photo library feature. And the way you enable it is you go into the Photos menu, into Preferences, and click on iCloud. And when you go to that tab, I also notice that the iCloud photo library, the photo stream, or what they call My Photo Stream now, and iCloud photo sharing are all separate checkboxes. So you don't have to necessarily opt in for iCloud photo library if you want to use or want to continue to use the other two features, because My Photo Stream and iCloud photo sharing, I know the photo stream does not count against your storage. That's where the 1,000 most recent photos that you've put into the photos or taken with your iPhone or iPad, those are automatically synced across your devices. That's still there. You can still leave it enabled. And iCloud photo sharing, if you just want to share small sets of photos or albums and things like that with other iCloud users, you can still use that feature. And I can't remember if that counts against your storage or not. I want to say that it does, but don't quote me on that one. And you can have one without the other. So I think that's the big thing there. The other thing you need to know about is if you activate the iCloud photo library option, you kind of have two choices. You can choose to have all of the original photos stored locally and then synced up to the cloud, so you're going to have full res copies in both places. Or there's also this option called optimized Mac storage. And if you pick that, what happens is all of your full resolution images are stored up in iCloud, but they are only synced locally if you have enough free storage. So this could be good if you have a second Mac, maybe you have a MacBook Air with not a lot of storage on it, or on your iOS devices where you don't want to eat up all that storage. You can check on that option, and it's not going to pull down and automatically sync all of your large files. The thing to be aware of there is make sure whatever the primary Mac you want to back up your photo library from, make sure that's set not to use the optimized Mac storage, because if you do that, you're not going to have all your originals. You're basically trusting Apple with all of your original large files, and ultimately, that means you've got those files only in one place, because I can't attach like CrashPlan to Apple's servers and get another backup of that, or I can't have SuperDuper backing that stuff up. You need to have local copies of that to work. So be aware of that. That's one thing I don't like about this, is you're sort of saying, you know, some people are going to end up trusting their main original photos all up into iCloud, and really, you know, what if something happens? I mean, Apple's probably accounted for this, but you're letting them take control of your backup system, and that's just something I'm just not super comfortable with. So just be aware of that. And the last thing I think to mention there on iCloud Photo Library, unfortunately, is that you cannot selectively decide what goes up into iCloud Photo Library. Once you've turned it on, it's really an all or nothing thing. It's going to put your whole library up there. So one thing you could potentially consider doing, because photos will support multiple photo libraries, is just creating separate libraries, you know, separating them into different ones, and then only you know, having a smaller one that you sync up to iCloud. So that could help you. But then you've got to manage multiple photo libraries, and that's not something I really enjoy doing. So that's kind of the rundown of the Photos app and some of my initial impressions and a couple tips and tricks. So I hope that helps maybe ease your transition into the new application. All right. And then finally for today, I have my thing of the moment. Like I said, this one might surprise you a little bit. It surprised me because I didn't think I was going to like this as much as I do. And it is the new HBO Now service that just went live this week. It's now available on iOS and on Apple TV. And I think one of the things that I really like about it was just the sign-up experience, what they call the onboarding experience, I think, is the sort of buzzword for it. But basically, it's the sign-up process. You know, what does it take to actually get set up and running? And it ties right in with your iTunes accounts because it is a subscription service, or ultimately a subscription service. Right now, it is U.S. only, so sorry for you folks who are international. U.S. only right now. Hopefully, this will be really successful and they'll roll it out quickly. The price on it is going to be $14.99 US a month. And right now, another reason why it's my thing of the moment pick is they are offering a free 30-day trial. So you can try out the service free for 30 days. Now, if you do take advantage of this, I recommend setting a calendar event to remind you to cancel, because I'm not entirely certain they're going to remind you of their own free will or accord. And the minute you hit that 30 days, your iTunes account is going to be charged because this is linked into your iTunes account, which is a great part of the process. It's also a potentially dangerous part of the process. But hey, you can try the service and binge watch all of the stuff that you want until then. And that's what I'm doing. I'm totally taking advantage of it. A series I really wanted to see was Silicon Valley, which I had heard good things about. So I just plowed through that in a couple days. I think there were only 7 episodes in there. 30-minute episodes, so and it wasn't a ton of content, but neat stuff, and I'm impressed so far. The app seems easy to navigate. The video quality has been very, very good, excellent for me, in fact, and I'm looking forward to watching more stuff on HBO Now, and I might ultimately become hooked and actually just opt in to paying for the service, although I'm worried about the ultimate piecemeal. Like, if I get this and then Apple comes out with their streaming TV service and I already have Netflix and then I want to add Hulu, or, you know, suddenly it's going to be like you're paying a cable bill all over again. And isn't the whole point to kind of move away from the big cable bill? It is, at least for me. The only other thing I'll mention on the HBO Now app is, while it's visually beautiful, just browsing can be a little bit tricky. They do have a search functionality, but I'm not familiar with all of the HBO shows, and specifically getting to back catalog stuff, you kind of got to click and poke around. There's not a lot of detail. It's very visual in most places. So they could maybe improve that experience a little bit more, but overall, just very impressed with HBO Now. So if you're in the U.S. and you want to check it out, I say it's worth it. Give it a try for 30 days and see how it goes. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and detail on all of their great applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and easy way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. Good luck to you if you are going online to get an Apple Watch. I hope you get the version that you want. I will be there joining you and madly pressing the refresh buy button, whatever it might be, hopefully not double charging my card, but that potentially could happen. Who knows? It's going to be mass pandemonium. If you have any feedback for me on that or anything else, you have a comment, a question, you can certainly shoot me an email. My email address is mattcast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave voicemail. That's 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IM-9. You're also welcome to contact me on Skype and leave voicemail there. The Skype name is The MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. Check out the forum while you're there over at forum.maccast.com. Great community of folks over there helping each other out and answering questions and stuff like that. So if you get stuck on something technical, they are a valuable resource. I don't think a lot of people take advantage of that, but it's there and available for you. So please check out that part of the community. Of course, there's also all the social media. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we do have a Google Plus community. If that's your preferred hangout, just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. That's it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.